Along with his fellow probationary constables, Ediard was sitting at a bench in the small hall of the Jevons station, listening to the weekly lecture on basic Macathran law. In another 2 months, they'd be facing a batch of exams on the subject, which they had to pass in order to graduate. Like all of them, he found Solarin a sore test of patience. A quick scan showed that Boyd was almost asleep. Maxon's eyes were unfocused as he long-talked the girls in the dressmaker's shop at the end of the street. Cansine appeared to be paying polite attention, but Ediard knew her well enough now to see that she was as bored as he was. Dinley, though, was sitting up with rapt attention and even taking notes. Somehow Ediard could not quite laugh at that. Poor old Dinley had so much to prove to his father and uncles, he undoubtedly would pass his exams with high grades. That presented the rest of them with the very real danger that, once they graduated, Dinley would be appointed their squad leader. It would be something he took very seriously. Thus the precedent was set for the lower ancillary court to hear any application to evict when a civil malfeasance is suspected of taking place within the property itself. In practice, a full hearing is unnecessary, and you may request a provisional eviction notice from the duty magistrate who acts as de facto high counsel to the lower court. And that, I'm afraid, brings this session to its successful conclusion. We will deal with the criteria for such application next week. In the meantime, I'd like you all to read Sampsol's Common Law, Volume 3, Chapters 13 through 27, by the time I return. It covers the main parameters of weapons usage within the city wall. I might even enliven our time together with a small test. How exciting that will be, eh? Until then, I thank you for your interest and bid you farewell. Solarin gave them a vague smile and removed his gold-rimmed glasses before shutting the big book he had covered with annotations. His G-monkey placed it carefully in a leather shoulder bag along with the other books the lawyer used for his lecture. Dinley stuck his hand up.
Sir!
Ah, my dear boy, sadly I am in something of a rush today. If you could possibly write your question down and submit it to my senior apprentice at the guild, I'd be most grateful.
Yes, sir.
Dinley's hand came down, and his shoulders slumped with disappointment. Ediard remained seated as the lawyer walked slowly out of the hall, assisted by two G-monkeys, wondering what Solarin would actually look like, rushing somewhere.
Ollivan's eagle tonight.
Huh? Ediard shook himself out of his absurd daydream. Maxen was standing over his desk, a smug expression on his face.
Clemenza will be going. Avala said she's been asking about you.
A lot.
Clemenza?
The one with the dark hair, always tied up in a long tail. Big chest. Big legs, too, sadly, but hey, nobody's perfect. Ediard sighed. It was another of the girls from the dressmakers. Maxen spent most of his time sweet-talking them or trying to set them up with his friends. Once he even tried to match Cansine with a carpentry apprentice. He would not be doing that again.
No, I can't. I am so far behind on my law texts, and you heard what Solarin said.
Remind me, there's going to be a test, Ediard said wearily.
Oh, right. It's only the exam at the end which counts. Don't worry. Listen. I've got a friend in the Lawyer's Guild. A couple of gold shillings and he'll gift us the whole Sampsols.
That's cheating, Dinley said hotly.
Maxon put on a suitably wounded expression.
In what respect? In all respects.
Dinley, he's just putting you on,
Cansine said as she got up to leave.
I'm being perfectly serious, Maxon said, his face as innocent as a newborn's.
Ignore him, she said, and gave Dinley's shoulder a gentle shove. Come on, let's find some lunch before we go out. Dinley managed one last scowl before hurrying after Cansine. He started to ask her something about the residency laws.
Must be true love,
Maxon warbled cheerfully as they turned out of sight.
You're evil, Ediard decided. Pure evil.
Only thanks to years of practice and dedication.
You know he's going to be our squad leader, don't you?
Yes. He'll get his appointment by the day after the Eggshipper Guild announces it's sculpted a G-pig that can fly.
I'm serious. His grades will be way above ours. Plus his father and a whole load of his family are already constables, senior ones at that.
Che isn't stupid. He knows that'll never work.
Eddyard wanted to believe that Maxen was right.
Eddyard, are you really not interested in Clemenza?
Boyd asked.
Oh, this is perfect, Maxen said, rubbing his hands together.
Way, do you fancy your chances?
Actually, yes, Boyd said with more courage than Eddyard had credited him with.
Good for ye.
She's a lovely girl.
As randy as a draken in a blood frenzy, I just happen to know.
Boyd frowned. How do you know?
Avalor told me, Maxen said smoothly.
Her last boyfriend was dumped for not having enough stamina.
Boyd gave Maxen a suddenly entranced look.
I'll come with you tonight. But you have to get Evola to put in a good word for me.
Leave it to me, my fine friend. You're as good as shagged, senseless already.
Eddyard rolled his eyes and promised the lady he'd be good forevermore if she'd just stop Maxen from being, well, Maxen. Come on, let's get something to eat before the constables grab it all again.
Oh, yes, Boyd said, our helpful and welcoming colleagues. I hate the way they treat us.
Only for another 2 months, that's all, Maxen said.
You really think they'll show us any respect after we qualify? I don't.
No, they won't, Maxen agreed. But at least we can shovel shit onto the new probationers. I know it'll make me feel better.
We're not going to do that, Eddyard said. We're going to talk to them, help them with problems, and make them feel appreciated.
Why?
Because that's what I would have liked to happen with us. That way, more people might be encouraged to join up.
Haven't you counted the numbers? Not just at this station, but citywide. There aren't enough constables in the city. People are starting to organize themselves into street associations to take on the gangs. That's going to undermine the rule of law.
Great lady. You really mean it, don't you?
Maxen said.
Yes, Eddyard said forcefully, and let them sense his mental tone so they knew he wasn't joking.
I know what happens when civil government means nothing. I've seen the violence that the barbarians use when a society leaves itself open to any bastard who knows how weak it is, and that's not going to happen here. Macathran can't be allowed to tear itself apart from within.
I don't know why you're worried about Dinley being squad leader, Maxen said, equally serious. You're the one, sir.
Eddyard was still slightly self-conscious about wearing the constable uniform in public. Only the white epaulettes distinguished probationers from regular constables. The rest of it was actually real, as Maxen put it. A smart, dark blue tunic with silver buttons up the front, matching trousers, and a wide regulation leather belt containing a truncheon, 2 pepper gas files, a pair of iron handcuffs with a fiendishly tricky 6-level lock that was just about impossible to pick with telekinesis, and a small first aid pack. Under the tunic was a white shirt that Sergeant Che made very sure was indeed an unblemished white each morning. Boots were up to the individual, but they had to be black and at least ankle high, though not over the knee. They also had to shine from polishing. The dome helmet was made from an epoxied dross silk mesh, with padding on the inside to protect the wearer's skull from a physical blow. Like the others, Eddyard had bought his own dross silk waistcoat, which was supposedly tough enough to resist a bullet. Maxen had gone one step further and brought dross silk shorts. In theory, the cost was not too bad, but in practice, every constable needed 2 tunics and at least 3 shirts. Then there was a constant supply of flaked soap for the dormitory's G-chimps to wash everything. Eddyard gained considerable kudos when the others found how good he was at instructing the G-chimps with laundry tasks. After the first week, Che stopped trying to find fault when they turned out in immaculate uniforms each morning. The daily routine hardly varied. In the morning they would have various physical and telepathic teamwork training sessions, followed by lectures. In the afternoon they would be taken out on patrol under the alarmingly vigilant eye of Che. Sometimes their division captain, Ronark, would accompany them. Evenings were, theoretically, all their own. Study was advised, at least during the week. Eddyard always hated it when Ronark did come out with them to check on progress. The man was in his 80s and was never going to rise any higher than his current position. His wife had left him decades before, and his children had disowned him. That left him only the constables, which he believed in with a religious fervor. Everything was done according to regulations. Variations were not permitted, and such infringements were subject to severe fines, restrictions, and demotions. Jeevan Station had one of the lowest recruitment rates in the city. Nobody paid any attention to them when Che led them out of the station at 1 o'clock precisely. Ronark was standing at his curving fisheye window above the big double gate, observing the shift change, clocking the patrols in and out on his ancient pocket watch. Out on the narrow pavement, a squad was double-timing back to the station, its corporal red-faced and panting as they tried to minimize their delay. 3 G-dogs scampered along beside them, happy at the run. Probationary constables were not permitted Genistar support. Thankfully, Che kept a discreet silence about Ediard's G-Eagle, which now lived with 2 others in the station's rooftop aviary. Jeevan's was a pleasant enough district. It even had a small park in the centre that a team of city G-monkeys kept in good horticultural order. There was a big freshwater pond in the middle, with exotic scarlet fish, measuring a good 2 feet long. They always seemed sinister to Ediard, who disliked their fangs and the way they looked up at everyone who stood by the rail watching them. But the park had a football pitch marked out, and he occasionally joined the games on weekends, when the local lads ran a small league. He enjoyed the fact that Jeevan's did not house many grand families. Its buildings were on a relatively modest scale, though the mansions along Marble Canal were regal enough. The carpenters, jewelsmiths, and physicians all had their guild headquarters there. It was also the home of the Astronomical Association, which had been fighting for guild status for 7 centuries, and was always blocked by the Pythia, who claimed the heavens were a supernatural realm, and astronomy verged on the heretical. Boyd, of course, was full of gossipy facts like that as they walked the winding streets. He probably knew the layout better than Che did. Che led them over a rival canal and into the smaller Silverham district. The buildings there were oddly curved, as if they used to be a cluster of bubbles that somehow had been compressed, squeezed-up insect hives, Boyd called them. None of them were large enough to be palaces, but they all belonged to wealthy families, the smaller merchants and senior masters of professional guilds. The shops all sold goods far beyond Ediard's dwindling coinage. As they passed over the ornate wooden bridge, Ediard found himself walking with Cancine. "So, you're not going out tonight?" she inquired. "Nah, I don't have much money left, and I really need to study. You're serious, then, about turning this into a career?" "Ask me again in a year's time. In the meantime, I'm not going to blow it by being stupid. I need to graduate." "All of us do," she said. Ediard eyed Maxen, who was lingering at the end of the bridge, exchanging good-natured words with a gondolier passing by underneath. The gondola's benches had been removed and replaced by a simple slatted platform carrying a pile of wooden crates. For someone supposedly thrown penniless on the street, Maxen seems to have a lot of coinage. "Didn't you hear?" she said with a superior smile. "What?" "His mother has been taken up by a notorious master in the Musicians' Guild. She's living in a nice little maisonette in the Kobara district. Apparently he's 110 years older than her." "No." Ediard knew he should not be interested in gossip, but such talk was Macathran's second currency. Everybody had some piece of hearsay or rumour about the district master families that he or she couldn't wait to share, and scandal was the greatest currency of all. "Oh, yes. He used to be in one of the travelling bands which tour the Iguru and villages in the Donsori Mountains." She leaned in closer to murmur. "Apparently, he had to stop touring a while ago because there were so many offspring in those villages. Now he just tutors apprentices at the guild building and plays for the families." A little memory surfaced in Ediard's thoughts. Late-night talk in a tavern several months earlier that he wasn't supposed to hear, and she had said, "Notorious. You're not talking about Dybal." Cancine's smile was victorious. "I couldn't possibly say. But wasn't he caught in bed with 2 of the lady's novices? That's part of his myth. If he wasn't so popular with his satire songs, they'd have thrown him out of the guild decades ago. Apparently they're very upbeat. The younger members of noble families idolize him, while the older ones want him to wind up in the bottom of a canal.
Yeah, but Maxine's mother?
Yes. Cansine seemed disturbingly pleased with herself, mainly because of his incredulous reaction. That was the way with her, always coming on just that little bit superior. He did not buy it. That was her way of coping with the probationary period, establishing a reasonable barrier around herself. It couldn't be easy being a girl in the constables. There certainly were not many. Che started off by heading directly for the plaza where the Chemist Guild headquarters was situated. The pavements between the buildings were a reddish-brown in colour, with a central row of thick cones rising to waist height. They were filled with soil and planted with big saf cherry trees, whose branches created a verdant roof between the bowed walls on either side. Pink and blue blossoms were starting to fall, forming a delicate carpet of petals. Edyard tried to keep searching the pedestrians for signs of criminal activity, the way Che kept telling him. It was hard. Akeem's memory had remained crystal clear and true on one aspect of city life. The girls. They were beautiful, especially those of the noble families, who seemed to use districts like Silverum to hunt in packs. They took a great deal of care about how they appeared in public, dresses that had plunging necklines, or skirts with surprising slits amid the ruffles, lace fabric that was translucent. Hair styled to look carefree, makeup skillfully applied to emphasize smiles, cheekbones, huge innocent eyes, sparkling jewelry. He passed one gaggle of maidens in their mid-teens, who wore more wealth with the rings on one hand than he would earn in a month. They giggled coyly when they caught him staring. Then they taunted him.
"Can we help you, officer? Is that really your truncheon?"
"It's a long truncheon, isn't it, Gillian? Will you use it to subdue bad people with?"
"Emily is very bad, officer. Use it on her." "Hannah, she's indecent. Officer, arrest her!"
"Does he have a dungeon to throw her in, do you think?"
Third hands performed indecent tweaks and prods on private areas of his body. Edyard jumped in shock before hastily shielding himself and turning bright red. The girls shrieked amusement at his behaviour and scuttled off.
"Little trollops," Cansine muttered.
Absolutely,
Edyard said. He glanced back just to make sure they were causing no trouble. Two of them were still checking him out. More wild giggles ran down the street. Edyard shuddered and faced front, hardening his expression.
"You weren't tempted, were you?" Cansine asked.
"Certainly not. Edyard, you're really a great guy, and I'm glad to be in the same squad as you. But there's still a lot of the countryside in you, which is good," she hastened to add. "But any family girl would eat you for breakfast and spit out the seeds before lunch. They're not nice, Edyard, not really. They have no substance."
"Then how come they look so gorgeous?" he thought wistfully.
"Besides," Cansine said, "they all want district master first sons for husbands, or guildsmen, or if they're desperate, militia officers. Constables don't come close, not in status or money."
After the plaza, they made their way along to the markets. There were three of them just a couple of streets away from the great major canal that bordered Silverham's northern side. They were open areas, not quite as big as the plaza, packed full with stalls. The still air was heavy with scents. Edyard stared at the piles of fruits and vegetables with mild envy, as the stallholders called out their prices and promises of taste and quality. It had been a long time since he'd sat down to a truly decent meal like the kind he used to eat at the Guild compound back in Ashwell. Everything at the station hall came wrapped in pastry, and none of the G-chimps in the kitchen had been instructed in the art of making salad.
"Those are melancholy thoughts," Cansine said quietly.
"Sorry," he said, and made an effort to be alert.
Che had said that markets were always rife with sneak thieves and pickpockets. He was probably right. Here, as always, the stallholders greeted them warmly with smiles and the odd gift. Apples, pears, a bottle or two. Pledges of a good deal if they came back off duty. They liked the constables to be visible. It discouraged pilfering. Edyard had been dismayed by the reception they had received in some districts and streets
as Che led them across the city. Sullen expressions and intimidating silences, unshielded emotions of enmity, people turning their backs on them, third hands jostling when they were close to canal banks. Che, of course, had walked on undaunted, but Ediard had been unnerved. He did not understand why whole communities would be repelled by law and order. They moved on to the second market, the one specializing in cloth and clothes. A dismaying number of young women strolled along, examining colorful fabrics and chattering happily among themselves. He kept a small shield up and did his best not to make eye contact, though there were some truly pretty girls that just begged for a second look. Maxen had no such inhibitions. He chatted happily to any girl who even glanced in his direction. "You never said which district you come from," Ediard said.
"I didn't, did I?"
Cansine agreed.
"Sorry."
"You need to stop saying that as well," she said, and smiled.
"Yes, I know. It's just that all of you are used to this."
He gestured toward the crowd.
"I'm not. There are more people here in this market than ever lived in Ashwell."
For a moment he was struck by real guilt. He thought about his home less and less these days. Some of the faces had faded from memory. Not Akim's. His never would. But Gonat now. Did he have red hair? Or was it dark brown? He frowned from the effort of remembering, but no clear image came.
"Belis," Cansine said. "My family lives in Belis."
"Right," he said. Belis was on the eastern side of the city, close to the port and directly over the great major canal from Sampaloc. They had not patrolled there yet.
"You've never been back to see them?"
"No.
Mother didn't approve of my becoming a constable."
"Oh, I'm sorry. Shame.
I think she would have preferred me to take the ladies' vows."
"Nothing wrong with that.
You really are from the countryside, aren't you?"
"Is that bad?" he said stiffly.
"No. I guess that's where the values this city used to have are kept alive, out there beyond the Donsori Mountains. It just gives me a shock to hear someone with convictions, that's all.
You're rare in Macathran, Ediard, especially in the constables. That's why you make people uncomfortable."
"I do?"
he asked, genuinely surprised.
"Yeah, but you must believe in values. Why else did you join?"
"Same as half of us. In a few years I'll shift over to bodyguard work for a district master family. They're always desperate for people with a constable's training and experience, particularly one like me. Female constables are very thin on the ground, and the noble ladies need protection as much as their husbands and sons. I can just about name my own price."
"Oh."
The notion surprised him. He'd never considered the constables as a route to anything else, let alone something better.
"Who do I make uncomfortable?"
"Well, Dinlay, for a start. He believes in truth and beauty just like you, but he's a lot noisier about it. But you're stronger and smarter. Che's going to nominate you as squad leader."
"You don't know that."
She smiled. It made him realize how attractive she actually was, something the uniform normally made him overlook. But that smile was a match for any of the silly family girls swanning around the market.
"Put money on it?"
she challenged. "Of course not," he said with mock indignation. "That's bound to be illegal." They both laughed.
"You two need a room," Maxen called over his shoulder. "I know one that'll give you cheap rates."
Cansine gave him a forceful hand gesture. He pulled a face.
"Why, it's three. You can't take the girl out of Sampaloc, but you can't take Sampaloc out of the girl."
"Asshole," she growled.
"We're on patrol," Che snapped. "What does that mean?"
"Professionalism at all times," the squad muttered dutifully.
"Then kindly remember that and apply it."
Maxen, Cansine and Ediard grinned at one another as they moved on to the third market, which featured crafts. Stalls displayed small items of furniture, ornaments, cheap jewellery and alchemic potions. There was even a section selling rare animals as pets. The awnings were a uniform orange and white striped canvas arranged in hexagonal cones, with centre poles swamped by eagle vine. It was warm underneath, but the full power of the sun was held back. Edyard stretched his farsight out across the great major canal that ran the length of the city from the port district to the circle canals, where the Orchard Palace was situated. Isidro district was on the other side from Silverham, wedged between the back of Golden Park and the low moat. It was where the lady's novice tree was sighted.
"This a good time?"
his mind inquired.
"Hello,"
Salrana replied with a burst of good cheer.
"Yes, I'm fine. We're in the garden, planting summer herbs. It's so lovely in here."
A gentle image gift came with her happiness. He saw a walled garden with conical yews, marking out gravel paths. Vines and climbing roses painted the walls in bright colours. There was a broad lawn in the middle, which was unusual in Macathran. It was trimmed so neatly, Edyard wondered what kind of genistar they used to chew it down. A snow-white statue of the lady stood at one end, almost as high as the walls. She was smiling down on the novices in their white and blue robes as they skittered about with their wicker baskets full of plants.
"Nice. Why don't you use G-chimps to plant the herbs?"
"Oh, Edyard, you have got to start reading more of the lady's teachings. The purpose of life is to achieve harmony with your environment. If you use genistars for everything, you establish a barrier between yourself and the world."
"Okay."
He thought that was stupid, but clamped down tight on the emotion for fear that Salrana would sense it. She was developing quite an acute empathy these days.
"Where are you?"
she asked. "I'm patrolling Silverham's markets." He let her see the bustle surrounding him, showing her the rich stall displays.
"Arrested anybody bad?"
"No, they all run in terror from us."
"Oh, Edyard, you feel sad?"
"Sorry." He caught himself and winced.
"I'm not. It's just boring, that's all. You know, I'm actually looking forward to my exams. This'll all be over after I take them. I can be a proper constable then."
"I can't wait to see your graduation ceremony." "I don't think it's that grand. The mayor hands us a pair of dark epaulets, that's all."
"Yes, but it's at the Orchard Palace, and all the probationary constables from the city are there, and their families are watching. It's a big event, Edyard. Don't knock it."
"I wasn't, really. Do you think you'll manage to get to it?"
"Of course I will.
Mother Gallian approves of formal functions like that. I've already told her you're graduating. Hey, those exams aren't easy, you know."
"You'll pass, Edyard. I asked the lady to give you simple questions."
"Thanks.
Can you get out this weekend?"
"I'm not sure.
It's difficult with the main service on."
Angry shouts up ahead made Edyard look around. His farsight could sense several minds inflamed with fury. Around them were minds blazing with sour determination. They began to move faster and faster. Shouts reverberated under the awnings.
"Stop them! Thieves! Thieves!
Kayvine is hurt!
Thieves in the market!"
Identical long-talk cries flooded into the ether. Jerky image gifts of faces clashed in Edyard's mind, too many and too poor to make any sense. His farsight swirled around the shifting commotion, contracting on the centre. Men were running, their arms flailing as people swarmed. Hands gripped long metal blades, swiping wide, keeping everyone away. Overtones of fear bubbled into the clamour of long talk.
"That's us!" Sergeant Che shouted. "Come on, constables! Clear the way! Constables coming through!"
His long talk was directed to warn people sauntering between the stalls at the same time he shouted. He began to run. Edyard immediately followed, as did Maxen and Cancine.
"Move! Move aside!"
After a moment of shock, Boyd took off after them. Dinlay had frozen, his mind radiating dismay. Edyard was running hard, keeping close to Che. People were jumping out of the way, pressing themselves against the stalls to open a path. Women were screaming. Children shouted, excited and fearful. The theft ahead was still kicking up a hurly-burly.
"Remember, act together,"
Che told them with remarkably calm long talk.
"Minimum of two at all times. Don't get separated. Keep your shields up."
Edyard sent his G-Eagle streaking through the sky, heading toward the edge of the market, where the thieves surely would emerge. Every street beyond the rippled roof of canopies had a covering of pleasant saff-cherry trees, their pink and blue blossoms clotting any view of the pavement and people below. His farsight still was concentrating on the criminals as they sped from the scene of the robbery. There were four of them, three wielding the blades, while the fourth was lugging some kind of box. From what Ediard could sense, it was full of metal, and plenty of the stalls around him were displaying jewellery. Che drew his truncheon as they burst through a group of people gathered around a couple of overturned stalls. A man lay on the floor, groaning and thrashing, blood pooling beside him.
"Lady!" Che exclaimed. "All right, stay back, give him air."
He scrambled for his medical pack and knelt beside the fallen stallholder.
"A doctor!"
Che's long talk demanded, rising over the general clamour. "Is there a doctor in the Silverham craft market? Wounded man?" Ediard's farsight still was following the criminals.
"Come on!"
he yelled at Maxen and Cansine.
"Where?"
Maxen demanded.
"I've lost them.
They've just reached the edge of the market, Albrecht Street. I can still sense them." He ploughed through the clutter of bystanders.
"Ediard, no!"
Che yelled after them. Ediard almost stopped at the command, but he could not ignore the fleeing thieves. "We can still catch them. It would be their first real arrest. So far all they had done in their four probationary months was clear drunks off the streets and break up fights. Never any real constable duty." He charged along a narrow passage between rows of stalls. Maxen and Cansine were racing after him.
"Come back!" Che bellowed.
Ignoring the sergeant sent a flash of wicked glee along Ediard's nerves. Stallholders were cheering the three probationary constables as they sped through the market. Ediard and Maxen were using their long talk to order people aside. By and large, it was working. They were closing the gap on the fleeing thieves. Ediard's G-Eagle swooped low over the saff cherry trees of Albrecht Street, its wings skimming inches above the waving blossoms. The four thieves were pounding along the pavement underneath the trees, heading straight for the great major canal. Their blades had been sheathed so as not to draw attention. Even so, the minds of people around them pulsed with curiosity and alarm.
"Where are they going?" Cansine demanded.
"Got to be the canal," Maxen replied. There was a lot of exhilaration flooding along his long talk voice. Ediard finally saw the end of the market ahead. The striped canvas roof gave way to the hazy radiance of blossom-filtered sunlight.
"Can you locate any other constables?" he demanded.
"Lady, it's all I can do to watch where I'm going," Maxen complained.
"What are you planning on doing?"
Cansine asked, all apprehension and doubts.
"Stopping them," Ediard said. "Isn't that obvious? What is wrong with her?" "There's more of them, and they've got blades."
"I'll take them down," he growled. Her uncertainty flowed away from him, as if it were another landmark he had left behind. They were closing fast now. Albrecht Street was almost deserted compared with the busy market, allowing the constables to race onward, weaving around the occasional recalcitrant pedestrian. The G-Eagle flashed over the last saff cherry tree. It showed Ediard the street, ending abruptly at the edge of the great major canal. The big waterway stretched away on both sides, cutting the city in half. Away to the west was Birmingham Pool, intersecting the outer circle canal. To the east, the high pool formed a junction with Flight Canal and Market Canal. There were only two bridges between Silverham and the Padua district on the other side, one beside each pool. Like every bridge over the grand major canal, they were narrow and steep. Most people preferred to use a gondola to cross the 150-yard width of water. Several were bobbing at a mooring platform where the street ended.
"Got them!"
Ediard exclaimed. "They just ran out of street." His jubilant mood suddenly dropped as the four criminals sped down the wooden steps to the platform and hopped onto a waiting gondola. It looked scruffy and badly maintained compared with the craft that normally slid along the city's waterways, with dull scratched paint and a drab awning. There were two gondoliers standing at the back, each holding a pole.
"Oh, Honius!"
"What?" Cansine demanded. She was red-faced and breathing heavily, but keeping up.
"Boat!" he gasped back at her. "Come on, we can still catch them."
Right in front of him, a very grand-looking old lady in a billowing black and white dress and her entourage of younger handmaids were leaving one of Albrecht Street's high-class restaurants. His long-talk demands to move did not seem to be registering with any of them. He dodged around the old lady, cursing. A third hand swatted at him, as one might strike at an annoying insect. He flashed her an exasperated look. The G-Eagle spiralled up, watching the shabby gondola ease out from the mooring platform and into the multitude of craft flocking along the big canal. Down market, the gondoliers might have been, but they knew their watercraft. With two punts available and working in harmony, they soon were moving a lot more quickly than anything else on the water. The four thieves flopped down on the benches and started laughing. Edyard, Maxin, and Cancine hurtled up to the canal bank, coming dangerously close to toppling down into the water as they stopped at the top of the mooring's wooden steps.
"Bastards!" Maxin shouted at them.
One of the gondoliers raised his green and blue-ribboned boater in a mocking salute. They were already 20 yards downstream. Edyard knew with grim certainty that they would be going all the way down to Sampaloc, and the wounded stall owner would be ruined.
"Help us," he called down to the gondolier who was moored below. "Take us after them."
This gondola was a fancy craft, its black paintwork shining in the afternoon sun, the awning embroidered with a scarlet bird crest. Somehow Edyard knew it belonged to the old woman behind them.
"Not a chance, pal," the gondolier called back. "This is Mistress Florel's private gondola."
For a moment, Edyard considered shoving him into the canal and commandeering the craft to set off in pursuit, except he didn't have the first idea of how to use a punt pole.
"Somebody help," he called with his voice and long talk.
That drew a few interested looks from the gondoliers out on the canal, but no one even asked what he wanted. A chorus of jeering carried over the water. 30 yards away, the criminals were leaning over the gunwales to wave and gesture. Edyard stared at his tormentors with a rage that chilled his blood. He smiled back savagely. Some hint of his fury must have flashed out. Maxin and Cancine swayed back. The jeering stopped. Edyard reached out with his third hand and plucked the box from the man holding it. Hands grasped empty air in futility as he lifted it 10 feet above the gondola. The thieves exerted their own third hands, trying to prize it back.
"Is that the best you can do?"
Edyard taunted. They never even managed to unsettle his grip. People on nearby gondolas watched in silence as the box drifted sedately through the air. Edyard's smile turned malicious as it landed softly at his feet. He crossed his arms and gloated.
"Don't come back to our district," he long talked to the departing gondola.
"Not ever."
"You're fucking dead, you little shit," came the answer.
Edyard pressed his third hand down against the bow of the gondola, causing it to rock alarmingly. But it was too far away for him to capsize, and the six of them hurriedly erected a strong enough shield to deflect him. Maxin started laughing. His hand came down hard on Edyard's shoulder.
"Oh, lady, you are the greatest, Edyard, the absolute greatest. Did you see their faces?"
"Yeah," Edyard admitted with a malign grin.
"They won't forget today," Cancine said. "Heavens, Edyard, you must have frightened the life out of them."
"Let's hope, eh?" He smiled at his friends, very content with the way they had bonded that little bit more from the shared event. A frilly parasol hit the side of his arm.
"Ow!"
It belonged to the old woman they had pushed past.
"In future, young man, you will display the correct courtesy due to your elders and betters," she snapped at him. "You could have knocked me over the way you were charging about with complete disregard for anyone else. At my age, too. I would never have gotten up again."
Yes, madam, sorry."
"Mistress Florel," she said,
her wavery voice rising an octave with indignation.
"Don't you pretend you don't know who I am."
Edyard could hear Maxin chortling behind him. It was muffled as if a hand were over his mouth.
"Yes, Mistress Florel."
Her eyes narrowed with suspicion. Edyard thought she looked at least as old as Master Solarin.
"I shall be reporting you to my nephew," she said. "There was a time in this city when the constabulary had decent people in its ranks. That time is clearly over. Now get out of my way."
He wasn't actually in her way, but he took a step back anyway. She brushed past with a swirl of her tent-like skirt to descend the steps to the mooring platform. Her entourage followed with immaculately shielded minds. A couple of the handmaids flashed him amused grins. They all settled in the gondola.
"See?" Maxin said, sliding his arm around Edyard's shoulders.
That's our true reward, the respect of a grateful populace.
Who is that? Ediard whined.
That set Maxon to laughing again.
You really don't know, do you?
Cancine said incredulously.
No. Among other family connections, Mistress Florel is the mayor's aunt.
Oh, I suppose that's not good, then.
No.
Every mayor, for the last century, is some relative or other to her. She basically decides who the Grand Council will elect. Ediard shook his head and checked the gondola below. Mistress Florel had vanished under the awning. The gondolier gave him a wink and cast off.
Let's get back, Ediard said.
A cheerful Maxon bent over to pick up the box. He shot Ediard another look as he felt the weight.
I can sense a whole load of necklace chains in here. Must be gold.
I hope he's all right, Ediard said.
Che? Cancine asked. She sounded slightly nervous.
No, the stallholder.
Oh, yeah, right. High above the Grand Major Canal, the G-Eagle soared lazily on a thermal, keeping the shabby gondola in sight as it hastened towards Sampaloc.
Most of the crowd had gone when Ediard and his companions returned to the scene of the crime. Several stallholders in their distinctive dark green aprons were fussing around the stalls they had righted, restoring the display of goods. Boyd and Dinlay were helping fix the awning directly overhead, which had ripped free when the stalls had been shoved over. The wounded stallholder was still on the ground. A woman was tending to him, a doctor's satchel open at her feet as she knelt beside her patient. Two young apprentices were aiding her. Between them they had bandaged the stallholder's chest. Now the doctor was holding herself perfectly still, eyes closed, her hands pressed gently on the bandage as her telekinesis operated on the torn flesh underneath, manipulating blood vessels and tissue. Her distinguished face was puckered with intense concentration. Every now and then she would murmur some instruction to her apprentices, who would apply their telekinesis as she directed. Ediard watched intently, trying to sense with his farsight as well. Old Doc Senio never had used her third hand to operate with, though Fahin had always said the technique was in the Doctor's Guild's tuition books.
You three okay? Boyd's long talk asked.
Of course, Maxon retorted.
Boyd glanced over to where Sergeant Che was talking to a group of stallholders.
Careful, he mouthed.
Che marched over, his face set in a furious mask. Ediard thought his boots were going to leave imprints in the grey-brown-marked pavement he was stamping them down so heavily. By some process Ediard did not quite understand. He was now standing ahead of Maxon and Cancine.
I believe I gave you a direct order, Che said in a menacingly level tone.
All Ediard's good humour at recovering the box faded. He'd never thought Che would be quite this angry. For once the sergeant was making no attempt to shield his feelings.
But, Sergeant, did I, or did I not, tell you to stop?
Well, yes, but...
So you heard me?
Ediard hung his head.
Yes, Sergeant. So you disobeyed me. Not only that, but you put the safety of yourself and your colleagues in danger. Those men were gang members and armed. Suppose they had pistols.
We got it, Maxon announced defiantly.
What?
We got it back from the bastards,
Maxon said loudly. He turned slightly so that he was facing the gaggle of stallholders and held up the box. The burst of amazement emanating from the market folk surprised Ediard. It also silenced Sergeant Che, though he continued to glare at the constables. Maxon walked over to the people closest to the wounded man.
Here,
he said, and proffered the box. One of the younger men in a green apron stepped forward.
I am Monroe. Kayvine is my uncle. This is what they stole from him.
He turned the lock dial with several precise twists, and the lid popped open.
It's all here, he said with a smile.
He showed the open box to the market.
All of it. They brought it back. The constables brought it back.
Someone started clapping, and soon was joined by the onlookers. Whistles of approval split the air, and then the three constables abruptly were surrounded by the men and women in green aprons. Their hands were shaken, their backs were pummeled. A beaming Monroe gave Maxon a hug, then moved on to Cancine. Edyard, too, was swept up in his embrace.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sergeant Che, a deep voice boomed. The stallholders fell quiet as Cetasis came forward. Edyard had seen him a couple of times before, normally when he was complaining to Che about the infrequency of constable patrols in the market. Cetasis was the head of the Silverum Stallholders Association, and through that had a seat on the City Traders' Council. He had almost as much political influence as a guild council master. "Did I hear right?" Cetasis asked. "Did the constables finally come to our aid?" For once, Che looked uncertain. "We were able to assist." He stopped glaring at Edyard and produced an almost sympathetic expression. "I was about to ask the more reckless members of my patrol to report what happened on the chase."
"Reckless members, eh?"
Cetasis grinned at the three probationary constables.
"Yes. You are young, aren't you? Good for you. If we had more constables with balls, we wouldn't be in the sorry state we are. Your pardon, my girl."
"Granted," Cancine said graciously.
"Come then. Tell me what happened on the chase. Did you manage to accidentally drop the scum into the canal?"
"No, sir," Edyard said. "I'm afraid they got away on a gondola. They headed down toward the port." Something made him hold back from mentioning that his G-Eagle was showing him that the thieves already had passed through Forest Pool and were approaching Sampaloc. "None of the gondoliers would help us," Maxon blurted. "We asked them."
"Ha! Fill rats in human guise," Cetasis grunted. "Still, you did a good job. I can't remember the last time a constable returned stolen goods."
He gave Che a meaningful glance, and the sergeant's lips tightened.
"You have my thanks. I'm sure my fellow stallholders will show their appreciation next time your patrol ventures into the market."
Edyard knew he was grinning like a fool. It didn't matter. So were Maxen and Cancine. Then he finally caught sight of Dinley, who looked like his closest family had just died. Once the doctor announced that Kayvine would be all right, Che declared that the patrol was over and they were going back to Jeevan's station. He led them out of the market without another word. Edyard couldn't work out if they were in serious trouble. The sergeant's mind was perfectly shielded. Maxen shot Boyd a direct long-talk query, which he shared with Edyard and Cancine.
"What did Che say?"
"Nothing much," Boyd replied, equally furtive. "He was yelling for you to stop. When none of you came back, he just concentrated on helping the stallholder. I had to hold the flesh together to slow the bleeding. Lady, I thought I was going to faint. There was so much blood. Monroe said they hacked him a couple of times with those blades to make him let go of the box. I wish I'd gone with you instead, but I just hesitated for that first second. I'm sorry."
"Don't be," Edyard said. "The more I think about it, the more stupid I was. Che was right."
"What?" Maxon exclaimed out loud. He glanced at Che, but the sergeant did not seem to notice.
"There was four of them, and they had blades. Six, if you count the gondoliers. We could have been killed, and it would be my fault.
We got the box back."
"Luck, that's all pure luck. The lady smiled on us today. She won't tomorrow. We have to act like proper constables. Stay together, work as a team."
Maxon shook his head in dismay. Edyard gave Cancine an apologetic shrug.
"I went with you," she told him quietly. "I got just as carried away. Don't try to claim this is all your fault."
He nodded. Up ahead, Che was marching on, not looking around, his back rigid. Beside him, Dinley was avoiding any communication with his friends. When they had walked back to the market from the Great Major Canal, the three of them had been triumphant. Now that whole mood was badly inverted. Right there, Edyard felt like turning around and heading out of the city. It was going to be awful back at the station. He just knew it.
"That's not the kind of attitude the returning hero is supposed to wear," Salrana told him.
Her long talk conveyed a lot of concern. Edyard tipped his head up to give the sky a sheepish smile.
"I'm sorry. We did it, though. We actually chased off some thugs from a gang."
"I know. I far-sighted you the whole time. You were terrific, Edyard. I wish I'd chosen to be a constable."
"Our sergeant doesn't share your opinion. And what's worse, he's right. We didn't behave properly."
Have you told the stallholder that? That's not the point.
Yes, it is, Edyard. You did a good thing today. It doesn't matter how you did it. You helped someone. The lady saw that, and she'll be pleased.
Sometimes you have to do the wrong thing, he mouthed silently. Some good cheer returned as he tried to imagine what Akim would have to say about all Che's rules and procedures. It would be short and very succinct, he knew.
What?
Selrana asked. Nothing. But thank you. I'm going to go back to the station now and do whatever it takes to put things right with my sergeant.
I'm always so proud of you, Edyard. Talk to me tonight. Tell me what happens.
I will. Promise. When they got back to the station, Che's temper seemed to have vanished. Edyard was expecting to be shouted at as soon as they passed through the big gates. Instead, Che stood there with a genuinely weary expression on his worn face. For once, his shielding had slipped enough for Edyard to sense just how tired his thoughts were. Small hall, he told the squad. The others dutifully trooped into the building. Edyard waited until they were through the doorway. It was my fault, he told Che. I encouraged the others to follow me. I didn't listen to you, and I ignored procedure. Che studied him, his mind becoming inscrutable again. I know. Now would you like to guess what will happen if Cetasis hears I gave you all a chewing out?
He'd probably take our side?
He would. Now grow up fast, lad. Learn how things balance in this city. Come on. I need to talk to all of you. The other constables rose to their feet when Che came into the small hall. Dinlay saluted smartly. Pack that in, Che said. His third hand shut the hall doors. Sit down. The squad exchanged mildly perplexed looks, except for Dinlay, who was still keeping himself apart. So how do you think we did? Che said.
Wrong procedure, Kansine ventured.
Yeah, wrong procedure. But we saved a stallholder's life. Some gang scum got a nasty surprise, and we recovered the stolen merchandise. Those are all the plus points. The constables will be popular in Silverham's markets for a couple of weeks. That's good. There's nothing wrong with that. I'd even go so far as to say the rule of law was upheld. Edyard.
Sir?
Did your eagle follow them back home?
Yes, sir. I watched them go into Sampaloc. It's a building not far from the Grand Major Canal. They haven't come out yet.
So we know which building they probably live in. What do we do about that? Do we put together a big squad and go in and arrest them?
Probably not.
Why? They've broken the law. Shouldn't they be brought before a court?
Too much effort for a minor crime, Maxon said.
That's right. So bring the eagle back, please.
Sir.
He sent a command through the sky above Macathran and felt the eagle turn around, dipping one wing vertically back to the ground. It began to flash back over the big canal. Che was giving him an odd smile. And you really can long talk that far, can't you?
Sir?
All right. Now, I'm not mad at you, any of you, so just relax, and for the lady's sake, try to listen to what I'm about to tell you. What you did today was what you joined up for, preventing criminal activity and protecting the people of this city. That's good. It shows you have a sense of duty and loyalty to each other. Technically, it's my duty to get you all through the next 2 months. Then you're on your own, and I start with the next batch of hopeless youths. My responsibility to you ends then. But what I have got to try and instill in you before you go out by yourselves is a sense of proportion and maybe even some political awareness. Let's think about this. Those gang members are going to be a little shaken by Edyard's strength and furious that they came back empty-handed after taking so much risk. Next time they go out, they'll want to make sure their crime produces some results. So they'll go the extra mile to make sure. Boyd, what would you do in their shoes? How would you make certain?
Take a pistol?
Very likely. So whatever constable patrol tackles them is going to get shot at.
Hold on, Edyard said.
We can't let that stop us. If we become so afraid of cracking down on the gangs that we do nothing, they've won. Correct. So, next time we chase them out. But that's it, Maxon said.
Good option, though actually your response was about right.
I didn't behave too well out there myself,
mainly because I was worried about you guys running off like that. There's an old natural law that says for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. If those gang members come into a market in broad daylight and use a blade on a stallholder, then they must expect a reaction from the constables. They were the ones who overstepped the mark on this occasion, but that still doesn't mean three of you can go chasing off after four of them, with or without blades and pistols. You were outnumbered. That has tragedy written all over it. So that was wrong. It was also wrong to leave a member of the public injured and unattended. You didn't stop to assess, which is the most critical thing to do. You also let raw instinct override my orders, which is the greater crime, no matter how much you thought yourselves in the right. I'm supposed to be training you to respond to situations in a professional manner, and I clearly haven't drilled it in hard enough. Now, I'm quite prepared to write today's lapses off to first-time excitement and the general confusion. You need experience more than you do theory, so nobody's getting disciplined, and there'll be no recriminations. But understand this. It must not happen again. Next time we encounter a criminal act in progress, you follow procedure to the letter. Do I make myself clear? Yes, Sergeant, they chorused. Then we understand each other. So take tonight off. Get yourselves down to the Ollivan's Eagle for a drink or ten, and be back in this hall for another dose of theory, first thing tomorrow morning. I'll go against my own policy to tell you something. Unless you completely screw up your graduation exams, you will all pass your probation.
I was useless, Dinley complained. I just froze. I was just so useless.
He gulped down more of his beer. Edyard looked over at Maxon, who simply shrugged. They had been in the Ollivan's Eagle for an hour, and Dinley had said very little else. It was a small miracle they'd gotten him to join them in the first place. He had not said 10 words since Che had dismissed them from the small hall.
You froze for a couple of seconds, that's all, Cansine said. That means you were close to Che when he ordered us all to stop and help the stallkeeper. You couldn't do anything else. I should have ignored him like you did. I didn't. I failed. Oh, sweet lady,
Cansine grumbled and sat back in her chair. She was wearing a blue and white dress with orange flowers. It was not the most stylish garment Edyard had seen in Macathran, or the newest, but she looked good in it. Her short hair still set her apart from all the other girls, who wore theirs fashionably long. But he rather liked it this way. It suited her, setting off a flattish nose and dark green eyes. Now that he'd known her for a few months, she was not quite as intimidating as she had been at the start. Not that he thought of her as anything other than a colleague and friend.
Nobody failed, Edyard said.
This afternoon was chaos, that's all. And you helped Che with the stallholder.
I froze, Dinley said wretchedly. I'll let you all down. I'll let my family down. They expect me to be the station captain within 10 years, you know? My father was.
Let's have another drink, Maxon said.
Oh, yes, that'll solve everything, Cansine said sourly.
Maxon gave her a wink, then shot a long talk order to one of the tavern waitresses. Something else must have been said. Edyard caught her flashing him a mock, indignant smile.
How does he do that? It's not what he says. It's his whole attitude. And why can't I do it?
Edyard sat back to give his friend a critical examination. Maxon was sitting in the middle of a small couch with Evola on one side and Nicolar on the other. Both girls were leaning in toward him. They laughed at his jokes and gasped and giggled when he told them what had happened in the market, an extravagant tale of thrills and bravery Edyard didn't recognize. He supposed Maxon was quite handsome, with his light brown hair and flat jaw. His brown eyes were constantly filled with amusement that bordered on nefarious, which was an additional attraction. It helped that he always dressed well when they went out. This night he had pulled on fawn-colored trousers cut from the softest suede, belted by woven black strands of leather. His sky-blue satin shirt just showed under a dark emerald frock coat.
See, I'd never have the courage to wear a combination like that, but he carries it off perfectly, the epitome of a grand family's junior son.
In fact, the rest of them looked quite drab in comparison.
Ediard used to be quietly pleased with his own black jacket, tailored trousers, and knee-high boots. Now he had been relegated to the poor friend whom Maxon's girls felt sorry for and tried to pair up with their own charity case girlfriend. On which note, Ediard tried not to stare at Boyd, who was sitting on the opposite side of their table, his face bewitched. Clemenza was next to him, chattering away about her day. She was easily the same height as Boyd, and must have been close in weight, too. Ediard could not help the way his eyes always slipped down to the front of her very low-cut dress every time she bent over, which was suspiciously frequent. The waitress brought over the tray of beer Maxen had ordered. Dinlay immediately reached for his tankard. Ediard fumbled with the money pouch in his pocket. "Oh, no, my round," Maxen said. His third hand deposited some coins on the empty tray. "Thank you," he said sincerely. The waitress smiled. Evola and Nicolas pressed in closer. Ediard sighed. He's always so polite as well. Is that what does it?
"Boyd," Maxen called out loudly. "Close your mouth, man. You're drooling."
Boyd snapped his jaw shut and glared at Maxen. A bright flush crept up his face.
"You pay him no heed," Clemenza said.
She brought a hand up to Boyd's cheek, turned his head and kissed him.
"A girl likes it when a man pays attention."
Ediard thought Boyd might faint with happiness.
"Got to go," Dinlay muttered. "Back in a minute."
He stood up and swayed unsteadily, then headed for the archway at the back of the saloon where the washrooms were. The fact that there were toilets on an upper floor was one of the many revelations about city buildings that had taken Ediard time to get used to. But then, a tavern that sprawled over many floors was also a novelty, as was the pale orange light radiating out of the ceiling that was nearly as bright as daylight. The first night they had visited the Ollivan's Eagle, he had wondered why there was no straw on the floor. Life in the city was so civilized. Sitting there in the warmth, with the window showing him the lights outside stretching all the way to the Lyot Sea, good beer, comfortable with his friends, he found it hard to fit this with the crime and gangs that cast such a shadow over the streets outside.
"What are you doing?" Cansine hissed at Maxen. "He's had too much to drink already." "Best thing for him. He's not a fighting drunk. Another couple of pints and he'll fall asleep. Next thing he'll know it's tomorrow and we'll be so busy he won't have time to brood. Tonight's what we need to get him through."
Cansine looked like she wanted to protest, but couldn't think how. She looked at Ediard.
"Makes sense," he admitted.
Maxen placed another order with the waitress.
"My liver has to sacrifice its life so we can get Dinlay through graduation," Cansine complained.
"In the constables we stick together," Ediard said, and raised his tankard.
"To the memory of our livers. Who needs them?"
They drank to that.
"Don't worry," Maxen said. "I've made arrangements. Our beer is watered. Dinlay's has 2 shots of vodka in each pint."
Even Cansine had to laugh. She tipped her tankard to Maxen.
"You're so beautifully evil," Ediard suggested, giving his tankard a mortified stare.
"This is watered? I couldn't tell. It tastes the same."
"Spot on," she said. "I thank ye." Maxen put his arm around the shoulder of the girls and pulled them in, kissing Evola first and then Nicolas. "Not just tonight we've got to worry about," Boyd said.
"Does our Boyd need to worry about tonight?" Maxen asked Clemenza.
She gave Boyd a hungry look.
"He certainly doesn't. After what you did today, you're all heroes in my book. That needs a lot of rewarding."
"He's going to want to prove himself," Boyd said. "Nothing the sergeant said is going to hold him back. Next time we come across a fight or a robbery, Dinlay will be at the front and aching to take on the bad guy."
"I figured that too," Ediard said.
"We'll have to be ready," Cansine said. "We can't hold him back. That would make it worse. But we can be up there with him."
"Everyone together," Maxen said. He raised his tankard. "No matter what."
"No matter what," they toasted with a roar. Ediard still couldn't taste the water. The 4G monkeys from the Jeevan's constable station walked slowly along the street, looking like pallbearers as they carried a comatose Dinlay home to his dormitory bed. Cansine kept looking back to check.
Do you think he'll be all right?
Not really, Edyard said. If Maxin was serious about the vodka, he's going to have the hangover from Honius tomorrow morning. He turned to inspect the G-monkeys. Using them wasn't the ideal solution, but it was better than him and Cancin hauling Dinley along. Boyd and Maxin had stayed on at the tavern with the girls. There were private rooms upstairs that they no doubt would be using that night. Edyard was trying to keep his envy in check.
Maxin! She exclaimed.
He's not so bad. Actually, I'd rather have him by my side than Dinley.
Some choice.
And you're preferable to all of them. All that beer and now the balmy night air were making him light-headed. That must have been why he had said it. Cancin said nothing for a while as they walked back along the long, nearly deserted street.
I'm not looking for anyone right now, she said solemnly. I just broke up with a man. We were engaged. It ended badly. He wanted a nice traditional girl, one who knew her place. I'm sorry. But I have to say it's his loss. Thank you, Edyard.
They walked on a while, shadows shifting as they passed under the bright orange light patches on the outside of the buildings.
I don't know what it is about you, she said quietly. I'm not just talking about how strong your third hand is. You stand out. You're what I imagine the sons of noble families are supposed to be like, or were like, before they got so rich and fat.
Nothing noble about me.
Nobility doesn't come from a bloodline, Edyard. It comes from within. Where was your village?
Ashwell, in the Rulan province. Doesn't mean anything, I'm afraid. I don't know any geography beyond the Aguru Plain. Ashwell was a long way past there, right on the edge of the wildlands. I'll show you on a map if I can find one. It took a year for us to travel here.
Gift me.
What?
Oh.
Edyard concentrated, trying to find a recollection that would do his home justice. Spring, he decided, when the trees were bursting into life, the sky was bright and the winds were warm. He and some other children had gone outside the rampart walls and taken the long route to the top of the cliffs, where they looked down on the cozy buildings sheltering below. He heard a soft pull of breath, and realized how heavily involved in the memory he had become, lacing it with melancholy.
Oh, Edyard, it's so beautiful. What happened? Why did you leave?
It was attacked by bandits, he said stiffly. In all the time he had spent in the station dormitory, he never had told his new friends the truth about Ashwell. All they knew was that he'd lost his family to bandits.
I'm sorry, she said.
For once, she dropped the veil around her thoughts, allowing him to sense the sympathy.
Was it very bad?
Selrana and I survived, and five others.
Oh, lady. Edyard.
Her hand held his arm. Don't worry. I've come to terms with it. Except for losing my master, Akeem. I still miss him. The emotional currents welling up in his thoughts were both unexpected and alarmingly strong. He truly thought he had put all the sentiment and mourning behind him. Now all he'd done was picture his old home, and the feelings were rushing back, as strong as the day it had happened.
You should talk to one of the lady's mothers. They give excellent counsel.
Yeah, maybe. He made his legs work again. Come on. I have a notion Che isn't going to be too gentle with us tomorrow. The G-monkeys laid Dinley out on his mattress and pulled a thin blanket over him. He never woke, just groaned and shuffled around a bit. Edyard could not be bothered to take his friend's boots off. He was suddenly incredibly tired himself. He barely managed to remove his own boots and trousers. The dormitory's G-chimps scampered about, collecting his clothes for the laundry. Of course, now that he actually was lying down, his mind was too restless to deliver the sleep his body craved. He sent a thought to the main ceiling's rosette pattern of illumination and dimmed to a nebular glow. That was about the only reaction the city buildings ever had to human thought. The G-chimps quieted down. Faint sounds from downstairs whispered through the big empty room, the usual comings and goings of the night shift officers. Edyard had never really gotten used to the way walls in the city curved. Back in Ashwell, walls were laid out in straight lines. The nine sides of his old guild courtyard were considered pretty adventurous architecture. Here in the dormitory, the oval bed alcoves were almost rooms in their own right,
with arching entrances twice Edyard's height. He liked to imagine that the dormitory was actually some kind of aristocratic bedroom, and that maybe the race that had created Macathran had more than two genders, hence the six beds. That would make the station an important building. He couldn't quite assign a use for the honeycomb warren of little rooms below ground that were used as prisoner cells and storerooms. As he thought about it, he let his farsight drift down through the translucent grey panorama of the station's structure. The image was such that it seemed to surround him, engulf him. Gravity pulled at his mind, and he sank ghost-like through the floor of the basement. There were fissures in the ground beneath, smooth fissures that looped and bent as they wound deeper and deeper. Some were no wider than his fingers, whereas others were broad enough to walk through. They branched and intersected, forming a convoluted filigree that, to his quixotic thoughts, resembled the veins in a human body. He felt water pulsing through several of them, while strong winds blew along others. Several of the smaller fissures contained threads of violet light that appeared to burn without ever consuming the fissure walls. He tried to touch them with his third hand, only for it to slide through as if he were grasping at a mirage. His farsight expanded, becoming tenuous. The fissures spread away from the station, burrowing under the street outside, knitting with other extensive, hollow filigrees that supported the surrounding buildings. Edyard gasped in wonder as his farsight grew and grew. The more he relaxed, the more he could perceive. Slivers of colour shone through his mind, as if this shadow world were growing in texture. He couldn't sense the dormitory anymore. The station was a small glowing jewel embedded in a vast wall of similar multichromic sparks. Macathran. Edyard experienced the wonder of its thoughts, immersing himself in a melody where a single beat lasted for years, chords so grand they could shake the very ground apart if they ever gained substance. The city slept the long sleep of all giants, untainted by the pitiful, frantic tempo of parasitic humans crawling through its physical extremities. It was content. Edyard bathed in its ancient serenity, and slowly fell into a dreamless sleep. Chapter 6. How long? Coriolan asked. Aaron growled again and ignored her. He was inside a gym cage that the starship's cabin had extruded, testing the flexibility and strength of his restored upper torso, pulling weight, pushing weight, bending, twisting, working up a sweat as endurance was evaluated, measuring the oxygen consumption of the new flesh, blood flow rate, nerve speed.
You knew Katux could do it, she whined, so you must know how long it'll take.
Aaron gritted his teeth as gravity shifted off vertical and increased, forcing him to pull the handle he was gripping while stretching at the same time. Bionix reported that the tendons were approaching their tear limit. His patience also was undergoing a strenuous workout. They had been back in the Artful Dodger for 15 hours, a time Coriolan had devoted to drinking and moaning. She now considered handing over Inigo's memories to be a terrible betrayal, not to mention a bad idea, a really bad idea. Stupid, actually, as she kept saying.
So it'll have, like, a mini Inigo hanging around inside its own brain.
Aaron took a look at the oxygen usage in his shoulder muscles. The levels were only a couple of points off those of the original muscle. Not bad for a couple of days. Drugs and bionics had done what they could. The rest of it was the result of good old-fashioned exercise. A decent calisthenics program should see the levels equalize over the next week or so. He shut down the gym. Something like that, he said. Coriolan blinked at the unexpected answer. She rolled over on the couch and reached for the pitcher of Tassimian Margarita.
So you ask the mini Inigo a question,
and Katux answers it for us.
Yes. What a load of bullshit.
We'll see. He slipped his T-shirt off and examined his torso. The membrane was starting to peel off. Underneath, the new skin was tender, but at last the color was deepening to the same shade as the rest of him. I'm going to take a shower, he said.
You're shaping up good, she giggled. Need a hand in there?
Aaron rolled his eyes. No, thanks.
He now had a strong theory of his own why Inigo had run away from Living Dream, and it wasn't anything to do with Last Dreams or the pressure of being idolized by billions. Maybe she only turned into this after he left. The gym sank into the wall, and there was a moment's pause before the shower cubicle extended out from the same section. He slipped his shorts off and stepped in as Corilin let out a wolf whistle. He must be recuperating. His cock was stirring. But if Katux did come up with a notion of where the reluctant Messiah was hiding out, his shipmate would be more necessary than ever. He turned the spore temperature down as low as it would go, and thought of other things. Unfortunately, with a memory that did not reach back past Ethan's appointment, he did not have much to mull over except his odd dreams. That horse ride. He'd been young, so it must have been his childhood. It seemed pleasant enough.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.